call this meeting of the House and Social Service Committee to order. It is 3:04, February the 28th, 2013. Present are Representative Nagyak, Representative Seaton, Representative Keller, and Representative Higgins. That's me. Let's see here. Some of our members will be leaving during the presentation, unfortunately. Maybe it depends how when we get done because of closeouts. And I apologize for that, but unfortunately that's the chaotic effort of the legislation. So nothing I can do about it. With that said, I'd like to recognize our staff today, which is Butch Carver, which is our House Recording Secretary. We have Stephan Gavin, is that correct? Stephanie? Okay. She's our LIO moderator, Paul Verhagen, which is my committee aide. So if you need anything, just raise your hand. Paul will grab it for you. A little housekeeping. If you have a cell phone, if you can please turn it off. If it rings, you will have to run down and get us donuts from the Breeze before we leave. So let's not do that. With that said, today we have a presentation. Our presentation will be by the Alaska Healthcare Commission. We will invite those who will be presenting to come to the table, introduce yourself, let us know your names and your positions for the record, and then we can begin our presentation. So come forward. Let the record indicate that Representative Tarr has joined us.
Good afternoon, Representative Higgins and committee members. My name, for the record, is Deborah Erickson. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Healthcare Commission, and joining me at the table is Dr. Ward Hurlburt, who's also the Chair of the Alaska Healthcare Commission and also the Chief Medical Officer for the State Department of Health and Social Services. And I also would like to recognize Representative Keller, who is the representative for the House of Representatives on the Commission. So Representative Keller has been a member of the Commission since our inception. I'm going to start off and just go over a few background details about the Commission and then turn it over to Dr. Hurlburt to present some more of the substance of our findings to date. The Healthcare Commission was initially established by Governor Palin under a governor's administrative order in 2009 and then established in statute by the legislature during 2010. And the purpose of the commission is to provide recommendations to the governor and the legislature on issues related to cost, quality, and affordability of health care in Alaska, and also to recommend strategies related to improving health status. And we provide an annual report to the governor and the legislature in January of each year. The membership of the commission is designated in state statute, and all of the voting members are appointed by the governor and serve three-year terms. And the various seats that they represent are designated in the statute. There is also an ex officio member from the House of Representatives and from the Senate, and representing the governor's office. I'm going to move along here in the presentation. I'm not going to go over the membership in any detail. I just wanted to note there's one change from the handout you all received a couple of days ago. It was just announced on the floor of the Senate yesterday that Senator Coghill has been appointed to represent the Senate. That seat was previously held by Senator Olson. Just a little bit, just very basic about the process that we've been following. We've been spending a little time at each of our meetings and in our interim work with trying to understand where we are today in terms of how the healthcare system is operating. We identified early on in the process a vision for the future for health and healthcare for all Alaskans. And so we also spent some time then studying some strategies for moving us towards that vision. The Commission's vision is that by 2025, Alaskans will be the healthiest people in the nation and will have access to the highest quality, most affordable healthcare. It's an audacious goal, but this is a vision for the future, something to aim for, to aspire to. And we've defined three very high-level measures, and we'll be working on some more detailed measures about how we achieve that vision. But to measure how our progress in attaining that vision, we've identified life expectancy, the percentage of the population with access to primary care, and per capita health care spending as the measures for where we're at. I've provided a list on this slide of the commission studies to date and what we have done to try to understand better where we are today, and can answer more detailed questions about that. But one of the things I wanted to point out is that the commission believes that really after we had counted at one point five different ad hoc bodies that have been formed either by the legislature or the governor over the past couple of decades that were formed to address concerns related to cost, quality, and access to health care. But believe that there was finally enough political will generated to establish a more permanent body in statute because of concerns regarding cost and affordability to care, and that's become now one of the greatest challenges to access to health care. So we've been very focused on trying to understand better what's driving health care costs and continuing increases in costs. And in trying to understand cost and really affordability of health care, we've been focusing on not just cutting costs. I mean, that we could, you know, take an axe and take a less sophisticated approach to trying to carve out costs in order to address that problem, but have identified the way to drive improvements in the system is really through increasing quality in healthcare services, improving efficiency and effectiveness of services. And so we're trying to focus on the value question more than anything else. And another cut at looking at some very high-level measures to indicate where we're at in terms of value, that being, you know, what do we get in return for the healthcare dollar we spend. We have we're 49th in the nation in terms of per capita spending. That means we're the second highest per capita spending state. Massachusetts actually passed us up. We used to be number one after implementation of their healthcare reform effort there. But while Massachusetts spends the most for healthcare per capita, we're 39th in terms of insurance coverage. And Massachusetts is number one. They have the highest percentage population with insurance coverage. There are measures related to quality and combination metrics for both quality and outcomes that the U.S. Department of Health and Social Services and Health and Human Services, and the United Health Foundation compile. And related to quality, we're currently ranked 38th in the country, and for health outcomes, the health of our population, we're ranked 34th. I'll turn it over to
yes, sir. On the go back to the other side there, the very first one, 39th at 18% uninsured, and then 24th at 14%. What do you mean?
The way the percentage of the population that has insurance coverage is measured, the federal government through the Census Bureau conducts a survey each year, and the way the question is structured, they don't consider Indian Health Service beneficiaries as having insurance coverage. They look strictly at third-party insurance coverage. And so the commission wanted to take a couple of different looks at that, and if we were to consider beneficiaries of the Indian Health Service as having financial access to health care, that 14% of the population doesn't have health coverage rather than 18%. Does that make sense?
Thank you. About the next dozen slides, I'll go through fairly quickly, and they have a lot of data about being sensitive to your time. We would not have a healthcare commission if it was not for cost issues. And many individuals in our country believe that's the dominant economic issue for the nation. Probably for Alaska, it's number two to energy issues. But it's a major issue and continues to get worse. On the left there, you see a graph from 1980 with some selected industrialized countries where we have always been more expensive than they have. This is in terms of dollar equivalents that we spend for health care, where we are now about $9,000, a little over $9,000 per capita. I do have gray hair, but when I got out of medical school, we spent less than $150 per capita on health care. And so it's gone up rapidly. On the right is the percent of gross domestic product, where if you take about 37 industrialized countries, we are between 50 and 100% higher than any one of them in that. We know during the recent recession time, and that we're still trying to recover from in the country, that the healthcare industry has been somewhat countercyclical and has been adding jobs, and that can certainly have a positive aspect to that. However, there was a RAND study done that showed that for every job you add in the healthcare industry, there is an offset of 0.85 jobs from something else, like manufacturing, construction, farming, or whatnot. There was a study that was published, at least on the Forbes website, I don't know if it was in the magazine, just this week, by Chris Conover, who is a research scholar at the Center for Health Policy and Inequalities Research at Duke University. And his analysis was that for every new job you create in the healthcare industry, there's an offset of 1.44 jobs. And in a sense, it's like a tax on our economy. Next slide, please. So what are results? This is a graph of a number of industrialized countries where the average life expectancy at birth is in red. The U.S. is in green. Next slide, please. Just in numbers, you can see infant mortality rates in the U.S. 6.1, way better than it used to be, but not as good as the comparison countries on the right. Average life expectancy the same. And we used to say if you got to 65 in the U.S., we did better. That's not true anymore. Next slide, please. This shows for the country where, going back to 1999, so the past 13 years, the bottom line is the overall inflation. It's been a relatively low inflationary time, 38% inflation cumulatively over those 13 years. The next line up with the squares is workers' income, done a little better than inflation in the U.S. However, the next line with the diamonds there and the blue, 172% increase in health insurance premiums and out-of-pocket expense 180%, so outstripping all of the others. And I will apologize, but read this slide. This is a quote from the Washington Post about a year ago. That says, if health insurance premiums and national wages continue to grow at recent rates and the U.S. health system makes no major structural changes, the average cost of a family health insurance premium will equal 50% of household income by 2021 and surpass the average household income by the year 2033. If out-of-pocket costs are added, the 50% threshold is crossed in 2018 and total household income 2030. At the top, I modified it because the last few years have been a little better, but we're still on a path, and that's why Commissioner Hultberg, Commissioner Struer, and others that have been testifying in the legislature have used words like unsustainable. Next slide, please. This shows the cost of health care in Alaska, where we now, in terms of dollars, we're a little over $8 billion, and projected by the end of this decade, by Mark Foster, an economist at University of Alaska, to be up to $14 billion of our economy. Next slide, please. Bring it closer to home. This is Anchorage. This goes back to 1982. Since that time, housing costs have gone up 75%. Energy, all items, the cost of living in Anchorage at 195%. Energy, where we've seen the blip the last few years, which is a double. It's bad for us when we go to the gas station, but good when we collect our taxes. 260%, but medical care up to 419%. Again, outstripping everything else. So next slide, please. What we're seeing is for Alaskan employers, the large employers that can sustain it more are beginning to drop providing health insurance, and the small employers, which in our definition of Alaska is 50 or less, dropping providing health insurance. Even GCI, I just heard it say, we cannot afford these continuing increases. Next slide. So why is it high? The Healthcare Commission commissioned a study by Milliman, which is the largest international actuarial firm, had 50 locations, about half the states here, And they look at this for states. They look at it for health payers, health insurance plans, and for providers. Our prices are very high here. These are prices for just a sampling of codes, not selected because they're the most outstanding, but between Alaska and comparison states, the three Northwest states and two rural small population states, North Dakota and Wyoming. Next slide, please. Some other comparisons there, where Alaska is the highest and by far the highest. For example, total hip arthroplasty, over $10,000 in Alaska. The lowest, North Dakota, $2,100, but the next highest at $3,300, a third of Alaska's. The Commonwealth North last July had a session in Anchorage where they had the vice president type people who deal with benefit costs for employees from NANA, from Alyeska Pipeline Corporation, from GCI, and from Providence as an employer as well as a provider. And the NANA person at the time commented, we have an employee right now who needs a procedure, didn't say what it was. It was going to be 11,000 some in Anchorage, 2,400 in Salt Lake City. Next slide, please. These are comparisons within Alaska. We think if you go to buy a car, if you go to buy 10 pounds of potatoes, you know what the price is going to be. You might negotiate on it if it's a car, but you know the price. We know if you ask your doctor what it's going to cost, he'll say, well, it depends. And that's an honest answer. Or if you ask the hospital what it's going to cost. If you look at this week's Time magazine, it's the first time they've ever devoted a whole issue to one item, one article, and it has to do with the healthcare costs. Quite frankly, I disagree with some of their solutions at the end, but the article points out the dilemma that we all face. And this is why the answer is, I don't know what it's going to cost. Generally, in most states, Medicaid is the lowest payer. However, there are three states in which we are one that Medicaid pays more than Medicare does. We've been able to afford it. We've done it to maintain access for Medicaid enrollees. But you can see workman's comp consistently the highest there, Medicare consistently the lowest. Next slide, please. And again, with some procedures, just showing the comparisons, pretty big differences. If you have, I'm a general surgeon. And if I were to do a laparoscopic cholecystectomy on you and you were Medicare, the charge would be $924. If you were covered by workman's compensation, it would be $5,500. So the I don't know to the simple question isn't reasonable for anything else. I'll turn it back to Deb.
Okay. Let's just spend a few minutes talking about some of the solutions that we focused on in our recommendations to date. But before I get to that, I wanted to talk about some of the just the general principles that we've considered in moving forward with solutions. And one of those is that a very small proportion of the population uses the majority of healthcare services. So, and this is national data. 5% of the U.S. population in 2009 required 50% of all healthcare spending, while 50%, half of the population of the country, was responsible for just 3% of all healthcare spending in the country. And we've had the question asked, well, how does that translate in Alaska? And we haven't investigated that specifically, but I know Commissioner Hultberg from the Department of Administration has testified in a number of hearings over the past few weeks, and one of the statistics she's used specifically for the Alaska Care members is that 70% of the plan members for the Alaska Active Employee and Retiree Plan have been responsible for 6% of all spending there. So 70% of that subpopulation is very healthy and doesn't require significant resources, while 5% of that population has been responsible for 59% of all the spending. And that's important to understand because it helps us focus more on how do we improve health, focus on in terms of health and value. If we can focus on developing policies that can keep the folks who are already healthy and not requiring those services, then that's a benefit in multiple respects. But then when we get to folks who require some moderate level of resources to the extent that those services that they receive are of the highest quality, we can keep them out of needing a higher level and more intensive services. And for those folks who already have multiple chronic conditions or more complex care needs, that if we could focus on improving how the healthcare delivery system works for them as well.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I'm trying to get a handle on the data about the 5% of the U.S. population. Is that on a lifetime basis? Is that on an annual basis?
Representative Seaton, through the chair. That is an analysis that's conducted by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services each year, and it's for healthcare spending in a given year. So that was of healthcare expenditures in the year 2009.
Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just want us to realize that what we're saying is the people that got sick in any one year, we spent money on them, and the people that didn't get sick in any one year didn't spend a lot of money. But, you know, it seems like it gives us the impression that we have one group of patients, one group of people that are very expensive and others that aren't, when actually, if that's the way the data is being collected, it just means the people that got sick in any one year required the most health care spending. But if you had an hip operation in one year, gee, you were really expensive, but the next year you didn't have anything, so you were one of the 95%. So I guess when I've heard that statistic before, I haven't realized that in those cases we're just saying that, you know, basically 5% of the people are sick in any one year, but it doesn't say anything about those people as a class going forward.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I think that's an important observation to make. However, from a lot of experience dealing with populations, it would also be true that there is a relatively small segment of the population that year after year after year do have repeated morbidities and repeated costs, so that probably half of your population, in a sense of where do you intervene, where do you manage, you could almost ignore because they're not going to use a lot of resources, but it is a smaller segment. And in terms of looking at where can you make a difference to really make people healthier and save money, it may not be the 1% that are absolutely the sickest, But there is a segment there that will have more morbidity and more costs year after year. So this is a one-year slice, yeah. But in strategically targeting interventions, that is true in a larger population.
I'll let you follow up in a minute here. But first, let me apologize for Representative Nagyak and myself. We have to run. Representative Keller will be handling for me while I'm gone, and if we get done quick, I'll be right back. But I have no guarantees, so my apologies for that, and we'll move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So go ahead, Representative.
And thank you. And I just would like to see the commission bring forward the information that we can understand on that basis, instead of making this huge assumption that, I mean, if I'm in an automobile wreck this year, I'm part of that 5% that took, but it doesn't mean that I'm sick, that I'm one of those people that has a lot of comorbidities and those kind of things. So it seems like if we would be able to separate those things out and get data on that, that would be very helpful in our understanding. That's all I think. So thank you.
Yes, that's through the chair, Representative Seaton. That's absolutely true, and we will provide that.
Representative.
I'm here. Just recognize.
Oh. Representative Reinbold has joined us. I'm sorry, my tongue wouldn't connect to your name real quick. That's why I was stammering there. Please continue.
Okay, just another principle that we've followed is trying to understand where there are opportunities for efficiency in addressing health care affordability and costs. And this is from a recent study from the Institute of Medicine where they attempted to address a statistic that we had heard and discussed over time, is that approximately 30% of all health care spending is waste. And so the Institute of Medicine spent a few years studying that issue and to see if they could somehow verify through analyzing a number of different studies and try to quantify or break down what the sources of that waste might be. And so they identified, I think this statistic did come out at 30%. We'd actually heard a range of 20 to 50% from a number of different sources. But they identified that 30% is probably about accurate, and applying that to total spending in the country, that would be about $750 billion in annual waste in healthcare spending, and attribute the sources to this breakdown of nearly 30% unnecessary services, inefficient care delivery, excess administrative costs, inflated prices, and so on. So the commission has identified a number of recommendations over the past couple of years, and looking at the general core strategies that those recommendations address, we've categorized them in these eight different areas.
Excuse me, before you go to those.
Do you mind if while we're on slide 23? It says $750 billion annual in U.S. healthcare. Do you have any idea how much it is here in Alaska?
Well, if we don't know how that applies, Representative Reinbold, through the chair, I'm sorry, we don't know how that, if the 30% applies directly, but if we were going to apply the 30% to Alaska healthcare spending in the year 2010, the total healthcare bill for the state was $7.5 billion, so a third of that, $2.5 billion. So our strategies focus on ensuring the best available evidence is used for making clinical decisions, increasing price and quality transparency, looking at how we pay for services and strategies for paying for value rather than and outcomes rather than paying for individual services, engaging employers and improving employee wellness and health plan administration, enhancing quality and efficiency of care as early in the care process as possible, and then at the end of the care process, increasing dignity and quality of care for seriously and terminally ill patients is another area we focused on. Prevention and also looking at some of the cross-cutting systems issues related to the healthcare system, especially workforce and health information technology. So I'm going to turn it back to Dr. Hurlburt for just a minute. We're going to go into a little more detail on each of those areas and turn it over to Dr. Hurlburt.
Before you do, we'll go back to Representative Reinbold. And do you mind if we just keep breaking in with questions? No, I didn't think you did. I knew you didn't, but it's really helpful. Representative Reinbold?
Love it that you guys are thinking ahead. I like this forward thinking, trying to solve problems. So I have to say thank you. And it's really been intriguing to look at your recommended strategies. I wish we could spend the whole session on this, but what are you focusing in particular on prevention from your level?
Representative Reinbold, through the chair, we have a slide that addresses that a little bit further on. If you'd like to wait, or we could. Thank you.
Do keep track of it. If it doesn't get answered, we'll come back. Okay. Okay. Go ahead.
I'll pick up again for one slide and talk about this for a little bit. We've talked about the high cost of health care. One of the things the Health Care Commission does is look at the cost of health care in relation to the total wellhead value of the oil produced in Alaska or the total private sector payroll, and it's extremely high, about 12 some point some billion dollars private payroll, $8 billion going to health care. And the state pays about $2.3 billion, with Medicaid being the biggest chunk at about $1.6 billion now, for state employees and retirees, both for what the state does directly and through the union trusts, about $600 and some million, lesser amounts through Department of Corrections and Workman's Comp. So it's a very significant issue. So do we just throw up our hands? Well, as Deb referenced, and as the commission heard in the very first meeting, but actually before I came on board, about 30% of health care that's provided is not really provided by high-grade evidence. And there is so much evidence now coming along. And I give the example often when I was in medical school, and I graduated in 1959, so it was a long time ago. But when we learned what did we do for heart attacks, and we learned things by mnemonics, and it was H-O-A-P. And Representative Keller has heard me say before, it shows we didn't know how to spell either. But it was humidity, it means putting you in a mist tent, oxygen, analgesia, it means pain medicine, and prayer. That's what we had to offer. I had a coronary artery bypass, and I don't think I would be alive without it when I was 45, back in the 80s there. Now if you go in and you have a heart attack, they'll give you the TPA, they'll give you the clot-dissolving agent there. You may get a stent. You may get a bypass operation. You will certainly get beta blockers because it significantly increases the survival. None of that existed when I was in medical school, and they're miracles. I mentioned stents because hundreds of thousands of stents are put in coronary arteries every year. About one-third of them are put in for what is called chronic stable angina. It is well documented in the literature that there is no benefit compared with good standard management by an internist. My daughter-in-law is an internist in Anchorage, and she can do just as well if I had chronic stable angina at less cost and less risk than putting in a stent. But about a third of stents, and that's expensive. That's $25,000, $30,000 each, with hundreds of thousands a year around the country being done. Some of the kinds of back surgery, the vertebroplasties have been shown to not really help. They generate a lot of revenue, and there may be a subliminal need to do it. We know that if you put in a new MRI machine, more MRIs will be done. It is estimated that with the CAT scanners, which again have been wonderful, to add that capability to increase our knowledge to know what's going on with the patient, but we use them routinely. I've heard it said they've replaced hands to examine an abdomen if you may have appendicitis. Well, let's get a CAT scan. It's estimated that we cause 36,000 cancers a year in the United States from the increased use of CAT scanners and the radiation to which you're exposed compared with what it was about 30 years ago. So there are downsides. So we need to really apply evidence. Evidence should be used in making coverage decisions. If you're an employer, if you're the state of Alaska as an employer, if you're a health plan and you're at risk, you should use the evidence and say, we will cover this. But if you're going to do something else, we should not ask the taxpayers or the employers or your fellow employees to pay for that. That comes into play. But the physician's role has also changed. The physician has become an educator as well as a doer. And it's a different role. Sometimes it's a little more challenging, but people are more educated. And it's, for example, do you as a man get the prostate-specific antigen test? I have had it once in my life, and that was by mistake because I got a blood battery. The evidence is there that when you look at it, it leads to surgeries that really don't lead to increased survival. And the surgeries are complicated by loss of continence, of control of your urine, loss of ability of sexual intercourse, and so there are downsides. I think what needs to be done, where probably any urologist or almost any urologist would say you're a fool not to have a PSA test done, but the physician, the primary care physician, should sit down with the patient and say, these are the potential benefits, these are the risks, and you're an educator, and then collaboratively make a decision between the provider, the physician, the nurse practitioner, and the patient. And utilization is less than that when that's done, and better decisions are made. It's a change from when I started. So evidence-based medicine comes into what are coverage decisions and what are clinical decisions there. Prevention has been mentioned. I won't say any more on that now because I know our time is short. But there's huge potential, but a huge challenge in evidence-based medicine. And that's an Alaskan issue. It's a national issue. It's an international issue.
The next core strategy that we've addressed is increasing price and quality transparency. And something that I failed to emphasize early on, but really is the most fundamental aspect of the approach the Commission's been taking, is how can we increase consumer and patient engagement in their own care and in their own health. And it includes making increasing their consumerism, their ability and engagement in making healthcare decisions. So, as Dr. Hurlbert just referenced, working with providers more as an educator and engaging in choice and decisions regarding their own care, but then having more access to information about the price and quality of services is another aspect of that. Do we have another question?
Yeah, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess with the healthcare system we have, what difference does it matter what the price is? There's no choice. I mean, there is, if we would insist on quality and find out, you know, what the ratio of bad events at certain hospitals would be or something. Of course, you know, we've seen the downside of that where some hospitals don't want to take patients that are at bad risk or at the worst patients, because then the risk is higher that there's bad outcomes. But what difference does it make if we supply consumers price information if they have no real ability to make any judgment based on price?
Could I interrupt just a second? That's a great question, I anticipate a good answer. But I think you're hurrying, because originally this was scheduled to be done at 3:55. Relax, we got plenty of time. There is nothing following this. Our committee is scheduled to 5:00, so we can relax and feel free to, you know, we can do some more interaction. And you have a 4:00. Yeah, but we still will continue on. So, and it'll be on the record. So, yeah, excuse me for that. But
can I tell a quick story, and then if you have something to add, Dr. Hurlbert? I thought maybe I would just share in response. I know to a certain extent, for folks who might not have an ability to travel, and especially for rural Alaskans who don't have an ability to travel, they might not have as much choice. But understanding what their out-of-pocket expenses are going to be when they go in for a medical procedure is an issue that we've heard a lot of concern and frustration expressed around. Around that concern, that you might get a bill 6 months later and aren't able to get information up front about how much your out-of-pocket expenses are going to be for a particular procedure. So that's one concern that we think we need to address. It doesn't necessarily get at the consumerism issue. It's more of a fairness issue. But I'll just share one story, and this is an Anchorage-based story, but acquaintance who approached me and wanted to share frustration and ask if the Commission could do something to help about this. His wife had recently had an MRI. It was recommended by her physician. The physician had an MRI in her office, and so without realizing, she had an opportunity potentially to either question the physician about why she needed an MRI or to find out what her out-of-pocket costs related to that might be. She went ahead and had it. The bill they ended up receiving was for $3,000, and her husband was so frustrated he made phone calls to other practices and clinics that had MRIs in the immediate area, within just a few blocks actually of where this occurred in Anchorage, and he discovered that there were price ranges for that exact same procedure, the low end starting at $1,500 and the higher end being closer to what they were actually being charged. And his concern and frustration was that it was very hard for him to get the information up front about what the prices were going to be, but then understanding that they potentially had a choice that would have saved them a significant amount of money out of their own pocket, that he wished that if there was something that state government could do, if it was something related to encouraging and facilitating providers to make their prices more transparent, that would have helped their family.
Representative Rebel, did you have a question? You have a follow-up?
Yeah, I guess so. I'm just, you know, we're talking about the majority of the population that does have insurance. I mean, because we only, if we included Indian Health Service, we're at 14% uninsured. So the majority of the population does have insurance. Most of the insurance have preferred provider networks. So if Providence says we have it at this and Alaska Regional says we have it at this, is there really any choice for the consumer?
Through the chair, Representative Thiede, let me try to respond to that. One of the goals that we've had is that we hope there would be more transparency in terms of what pricing is and in terms of what outcomes are, quality-related transparency there. And we're seeing, for example, on one of the graphs that I showed, it showed that while health care insurance premiums have been going up, the out-of-pocket costs have been going up even higher. And as employers feel more and more pressure, one of their responses is to cost shift. We got to the place, and we all know the history, during World War II when wages couldn't be raised. One of the ways employers could recognize the hard work their employers were doing and they were being profitable was to provide health insurance. And so you had companies like Boeing that even recently, and I don't know if they've changed, had what we would call first dollar coverage. So there's nothing out of pocket. So then you don't have skin in the game. What difference does it make? But the costs are shifting more. One of the suggestions that has been pursued has been what would be called a health savings account, where your insurance would be more for catastrophic events, but not for the everyday events. And the analogy is you have insurance for your car in case you have an accident and get a small dent on your bumper and it costs $2,000. But you don't have it to buy gas or to change the oil and the filter there. So that's one of the ways to look at it. There's what's called an all-payer claims database that's one of the bullets here that Deb has, and we'll be having a report on that at our meeting next week. About a dozen states.
Excuse me.
Sorry.
What I'm going to do is call them at ease. And
we need to go back on record. Okay. The question again was that the statement that if we were provided costs, consumers could control their costs. And the question that I was asking, if we're using preferred provider networks, all the insured people, which is, according to your figures, about 86% of Alaskans, those insurance companies that have preferred provider networks do not allow the consumer to move out of that network. So I was asking how providing the cost information to the consumers will actually allow them to exercise control of healthcare costs if they have to go to the preferred provider network as their insurance dictates.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Seaton. Even within a network, you can have different difference in prices. But the value of the network, say, is twofold. One is that if a payer negotiates with a network or with a provider, with a hospital, and can provide what's called steerage, in other words, send the business, then you can get a lower rate. Right now, and really for the first time, the state, for the active employees that the state covers, it's not through the union trust, has a contract with regional hospitals. So for the things that regional does, that's the preferred hospitals to go to, and it reduces costs. The other aspect of it is, and the job that I had for the last 5 years before we moved back up here, was as a chief medical officer for a Medicaid managed care plan in the state of Washington. We had 330,000 enrollees, and as we all would recognize, as folks who tend to be socioeconomically less advantaged in our society, those folks often have more morbidity. Our neonatal infant mortality rate, which means deaths in the first month of life, and that's felt to reflect medical care, whereas the next 11 months is more living conditions. But our neonatal infant mortality rate for a Medicaid population, and we had as many deliveries as the state of Alaska has for the whole state each year, was less than half that of the U.S. all races. I believe that was mostly due because of our credentialing process, and we assured that we had high-quality providers, physicians, nurse midwives, and whatnot, so that with a larger buyer of health care, you can look at the quality issues and you can assure that your enrollees are seeing providers that provide good quality. Now, the answer would be no, they just want to get the cheapest price and they don't care about the quality. That hasn't been my experience. People in the industry, whether it's for-profit or non-profit or government, really want to do the right thing generally. And I think that it has helped assure quality there. Then one last comment. I spent several years with Group Health, which is a staff model in the Washington area with about 600,000 enrollees. About two-thirds provided care through the staff model to about 200,000 through contracts. And we had our own two hospitals. And I led the non-primary care parts of that program in the Puget Sound area with our hospitals, nursing home, non-primary care physicians, and clinics. And folks would say, well, I don't want to go to Group Health because I can't have my choice. And my answer would be, we had 1,000 employed physicians. How much choice can you handle? So it does limit your choice somewhat to have a preferred provider network. But generally, you're going to have choice within that, not unlimited, but it does help assure quality and help control costs.
And Madam Chair, follow-up. I'm not objecting at all to preferred provider networks. I think they're, but the question is, we're talking about trying to look at price and let consumers choose by price, and I am trying to understand how price within a preferred, I mean, it seems to conflict with the idea of a preferred provider network. So if 86% of our people have insurance coverage, and if most of those have preferred provider networks, then I'm trying to understand from the commission standpoint how price sensitivity is going to do anything for me as a insured consumer to make any decisions. Because I think if you're within the preferred provider network and you're at the doctor, whether it's at, let's say it's Providence or regional, Alaska Regional, which the state healthcare is through, I mean, I don't think you're going to have, say, Dr. A is $150 an hour or $600 an hour, and Dr. B is $580 an hour. I mean, I don't think that that's the kind of discrimination on cost basis that is going to be expected for the consumer to look at within the preferred provider network. And so I'm trying to figure out how this gives us a big bang for the buck within the preferred provider network.
Yes, through the chair. Thank you, Representative Seaton. In my experience, even within a preferred provider network, the prices won't be totally uniform. And then in addition, most plans will allow an individual to go out of network, but they have to pay more. The copay's bigger, the deductible may be larger on that, but it does give you the ability to look at that. But if you had a network where the pricing was exactly the same, the copay was the same, then the advantage to you more would be in looking what are the quality issues there, what are the outcomes, how is it rated in terms of quality by a group like LeapFrog, for example.
Yep. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Okay. Move on. Okay, another area that we focused on in terms of solutions is payment reform, looking at different ways. So right now, in a fee-for-service environment, every individual service has a charge. And so we've been looking at how redesigning payment structures could incentivize quality, efficiency, and effectiveness more. And there is a whole range of approaches to payment reform, but our preliminary recommendations is that the state health programs, various programs, Dr. Hurlburt mentioned earlier that approximately 25% of all health care spending in this state is state government spending. If you combine Medicaid and employee and retiree health plans and some of the other smaller programs that participate in spending health care dollars, and that there's an opportunity for leveraging purchasing power if those programs combine. I know Commissioner Struer and Commissioner Hultberg have been in regular conversations about healthcare costs and aligning strategies, and have actually made presentations to that regard. Mm-hmm. Taking a phased approach might start with keeping a fee-for-service system, and that's what the commission recommended, but adding some additional payment enhancements to facilitate moving the system more towards increased quality and efficiency. And so, for example, the Department of Health and Social Services is looking to implement a patient-centered medical home pilot demonstration to strengthen and improve primary care delivery for Medicaid patients. And one aspect of that might be providing an enhanced payment to facilitate coordination of care and care management. So that's another part of that approach and another recommendation related to payment reform. Engaging employers to improve health plans and employee wellness is another area. Dr. Hilbert mentioned the CEO of a manufacturing firm that from outside who came up, and we partnered with Commonwealth North having this presentation and conversation with the employer in the business community. And this is actually a cover. It's not that we're endorsing this particular book or this speaker, but the company that solved healthcare is actually a book that the CEO had written following their experience, just to tell one story.
Just one moment. That was a fabulous presentation. I was there with Commonwealth North. I have the book. It is an amazing, amazing story. And anyway, thanks for pointing that out. And I've seen Commissioner Hultberg speak, and she, and I know Commissioner Struer are very serious about this issue. And I mean, you have to applaud them for trying to solve the problems that we have facing us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the recommendations related to engaging employers, again, starting with the focus, one of the things we learned through that presentation and in conversations with other employers. Not, we didn't just invite the speaker from outside to share his one experience, but following that, we had a panel presentation of Alaskan employers from both the public sector and the private sector sharing their experiences and some of the approaches that they're beginning to take to both improve employee wellness and to look at redesigning their health plans. And one of the things that was emphasized again was the importance of price and quality transparency. So we have, again, a related recommendation for that. Hearing from Commissioner Hultberg and the work that she's doing with the Alaska Care Plan and the improvement she's trying to make there, the commission suggested that the legislature and the governor not only continue to support her efforts, but also that she could provide some leadership for the business community as an employer in that regard. And we identified what were the four essential elements of a successful employee health management, taking both approaches again to looking at what employers can do while employees are their kind of captive audience for probably half of their waking hours, at least during the week, that to the extent that they could provide supports for healthy lifestyles, that there, that be an important focus, but also price sensitivity, the issue that we were discussing a few minutes ago.
I'm going to take just a brief at ease. Okay.
Strategies Representative Higgins and Representative Keller, and we're up to the fourth one. We talked about price and quality transparency and also payment reform and the importance of evidence-based medicine early on. And we're at our fourth strategy now, which is engaging employers. And we were talking about the importance of not just price and quality transparency, but price sensitivity to that effect, and how the way health plans are designed can engage the health plan member more in experiencing and sharing in the cost sharing of, and will incentivize more participation on their part in making decisions based on price and quality. And then the third aspect, I'm skipping around a little bit, but proactive primary care. The other thing we learned is, again, emphasizing and making primary care available, easily available to plan members is something that's been demonstrated to improve quality and cost. And we're going to continue investigating over this year what we could recommend more specifically related to supporting employers in Alaska to engage more in both in employee wellness and in health plan design improvement. The fifth area is focusing again on improving quality and efficiency of care at the front end, recognizing the value of primary care. One of the things we learned, and Dr. Hurlburt shared earlier, just comparisons of total spending and also health status with between the United States and other countries. One of the things that we recognized early on was some of those other countries that have lower spending and higher health outcomes have a much greater investment in the primary care part of the healthcare delivery system. When you look at total resources in terms of both utilization of services and workforce, that there's more of an emphasis on generalists as opposed to specialists, where in the United States we have a greater spending and emphasis on specialty care, which in part driving the higher costs. Promoting the relationship between patients and clinicians, again, depending on how those systems and services are designed, there are ways to do that. Supporting health programs to implement patient-centered primary care models, the new models of care that emphasize improved care coordination and involvement of the primary care provider in care management and care coordination. And also supporting a high-quality, coordinated, and comprehensive trauma care system is another aspect of the recommendations to date in this area. This past year, we spent a little time looking at the issue of end-of-life care. And so one of the other solutions that we've identified is increasing both dignity and quality of care for seriously and terminally ill patients, and identified that there's a lot of room for improvement, and that that patients or potential future patients would have a much greater chance of having their decisions honored if they engage early on in planning for and addressing their decisions related end of life issues. That there is a lot of opportunity for improving education and training for clinicians about the value of palliative care and pain management, and that we currently have a program called Comfort One on the books that provides a tool and a mechanism for terminally ill patients to document for first responders their end-of-life wishes. But there is another program that's evolving and spreading across the country. It's typically called PULSED. There are different acronyms for it, but that stands for Physician's Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. And it's another standardized mechanism that provides a tool for clinicians and patients to share together in decision-making about treatment wishes and documenting those. And then there's we have a recommendation related to making advanced directives more easily accessible and available to clinicians through an electronic registry. And finally, a suggestion that the state could pilot or do demonstration projects related to palliative care, making it more accessible to underserved populations, both rural Alaskans who might not have direct access to physicians with expertise in palliative care and other clinicians with expertise in palliative care, and also that there are, might be opportunities for redesigning payment structures to better support that as well. So we have some recommendations related to that.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. So does the commission support the bill that's in the legislature for advanced health care directives registry?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, the commission doesn't take a position on legislation, either federal or state legislation. We have been studying issues and put out recommendations related to them, but then we won't take positions on specific legislation.
Follow up. So has the commission identified areas that the subject before the legislature is either inadequate or is adequate, or areas that need to be improved? I mean, we're sitting here with a bill that we're trying to move forward with, and if we don't know if it's good or bad because we don't have any input other than there should be a electronic registry, but if the commission's been studying the issues, at least if the details of all the points that should be in the registry and those that should not, if the commission can forward those to us, that would be helpful. Otherwise, we're sitting here without the aid of the expertise of the commission. So, Mr. Chairman, I just don't know how to get there then.
Okay.
other than requesting
some information from you guys. Mm-hmm. So what we'll do is we'll get Paul to make sure you connect with them so that we get those to them. And I'll get those to the committee. You guys can get that to us, right? Do you understand the question? Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Yes. And now to Representative Reinbold's earlier question. The seventh area is focusing on prevention. And the commission, In trying to learn about this more, what we did was invite both our state public health director and our state behavioral health director to come and share with us what they would identify as the top issues related to population-based prevention, since we've been focused primarily on affordability of healthcare services. We didn't put a lot of time and resources into studying the issue of prevention, but based on those recommendations, the commission identified recommendations related to obesity and increasing immunization rates, and also the importance of integrating behavioral health and primary care services and supporting screening for adverse childhood, a history of adverse childhood events, substance abuse, and depression. Dr. Herbert, I don't know if you would want to, since we have a lot more time, if you want to add anything related to obesity or prevention or...
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. How much data do we have? How many studies? How many randomized control trials do we have on the history of adverse childhood events? That, you know, other than just general knowledge, that lead us to the screening for those and direct knowledge of what the outcomes are? How good is that? How good is that data? Is that type 1 data? Is that?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I don't know, I have to say. I was not aware of this actually till I came into this job, and Melissa Stone, who's the director of the Division of Behavioral Health, made me aware of the ACEs studies. And from what I've seen, I've been very impressed. I think those studies initially came out of San Diego, and you may be familiar with that. If you're not, we could certainly get you copies. but it is more in the behavioral health area, so not so much in the Division of Public Health. And in my background, I'm not expert in that to be able to answer the question, but I know we could get you the articles, if you, and, you, and you may be familiar with them already.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
I am familiar with some of those articles, and I'm concerned that sometimes we take certain things and say, oh, well, gee, this is obvious, this is good data, this is, or there are studies that we're going, there are no clinical trials, there are other things, and we proceed along as if we have absolute knowledge, and now we're screening for these, and I'm not objecting, but I'm just trying to figure out if the department is saying that we have identified something that we need to screen for, and I want to make sure of what your confidence in the data is as the director of public health and the representative of the department as to the quality of that data, because if we are not assessing the quality of the data, then I'm not sure how our recommendations go forward. So I would like to get the department to analyze that a little bit and let us know so that we're proceeding on all similarly on many objectives.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, what I guess I would like to do then would maybe to request of Melissa Stone that she help us with that and help put a response together for you.
Sure, and I'd appreciate that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Would you like anything to this discussion at this point, or should we move on?
Well, let's go ahead.
Okay. And the final area is related to the those cross-cutting issues, again, that we identified as the foundation for a sustainable healthcare system, is having a strong health information infrastructure and also having a sustainable workforce. And so we have a series of recommendations related to those. This past year, related to the health information infrastructure, we're focused especially on fostering the use of telemedicine for increasing access to care, just as one example. Another aspect of the health information infrastructure is having sufficient data for being able to support both public policy making, but also supporting clinicians and patients in making clinical decisions. And so encouraging participation in the hospital discharge database, and also the our continuing work to study whether we can make the business case for an all-payer claims database for Alaska is in this area. And then we recognized, related to workforce, that we don't just always need more because, for example, we might have vacancies in a particular area. We recognized that care models are evolving and the healthcare delivery system is going to be evolving rapidly as it responds to pressures from the Affordable Care Act implementation, as well as pressures from payers. And the fact that Alaska's approach to workforce development has been pretty innovative in some areas, and that we acknowledge that and continue to support it. And also, again, to some of the earlier comments related to the importance of primary care, that to the extent state government is engaging in supporting workforce development, that they focus on needs related to primary care.
Yeah, we need to, as far as the workforce goes, that I've recognized over the years, is that we need to create a model or a plan, and CHAPS program is a great example of that. But we need to take that a little further. You know, we need to home grow our own workforce, basically, because we have a turnover rate. When people come up in the lower 48 all the time, they think they know what they're getting into, and then they leave. That's just the way Alaska is. I mean, I grew up here, so I'm used to it. I'm never going to leave the state, so this is where I'm at. But so to stop that turnover, we need to start encouraging our youth and our kids, especially in the rural areas, and start working them into the pipeline in the healthcare delivery system, so that they stay in the areas that they are growing up in, because they're used to that area. So we need to develop good workforce development in that. And how we do that, well, that's where all the stakeholders get together, and we have to work on that. So we have to, you know, look outside the box sometimes, but that's an important issue.
I had a question on the workforce development portion. We've got now, I guess, community mental health aides that have gone through, but my understanding is that somehow we don't have the right code so that they can't get paid under the Medicaid provisions. Is that being resolved? I mean, it's a real shame to have workforce being trained and then not being able to bill or get paid. So does the commission has been involved in that at all?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, the commission hasn't been directly involved in that particular question. We probably should defer to our state Medicaid program to answer it. My understanding is that one of the more advanced levels of behavioral health aides is being reimbursed, and they're looking at questions related to the lower levels. But that would be a question for our state Medicaid program. Or we could find that question and follow up.
One of the things I've looked into that was it has to do with the training, you know, that Medicaid looks at and says, okay, first can we bill out for that? And from my understanding is their training is not to what this, what it should be for the billing purposes of that. So that needs to be looked at. From what I've my little research into that problem. So that's why I'm getting back to the workforce. If we're going to do this, then we have to create a training that will work and cover that. And sometimes the training takes longer than a one-week training course to become a mental health aide, you see. I mean, so we have to definitely look at that. So, and go ahead. Is there anything more?
I wanted to reference the Affordable Care Act. The commission isn't engaging directly in developing recommendations related to the Affordable Care Act for a variety of reasons. One, that the commission doesn't feel that it was their charge to evaluate the federal policy that's being put in place. Essentially, those policies have already been established, and it would be getting more at a little bit of an operational level for whether and how state government might engage in participating in implementing the Affordable Care Act or not. And the other issues would have just taken all of our time and resources to fully engage in that. At the same time, it certainly is very significant. We need to understand the implications of the healthcare delivery system and the implications for Alaskans of implementation of the Affordable Care Act. So one of the compromises we've struck related to that is we spend a little bit of time at each of our commission meetings updating commission members on status of implementation of various provisions of the act, and we have some information related to that. Finally, I just wanted to share the commission's plans for 2013. We're going to spend some time, again, continuing to study and try to understand better how the current healthcare delivery and financing system is working. And to that end, we're going to be focusing on health insurance costs and cost drivers, how healthcare accounting and pricing works, looking at hospital readmission rates and some other quality metrics that are starting to be implemented by the Medicare program, the federal government, through Medicare especially, but moving towards pay for performance and how quality and payment are coming together in different approaches to payment reform. We'll spend a little time learning this year about oral health status in Alaska and dental services. And again, we'll continue tracking implementation of federal health care reform here. And we're going to delve a little bit deeper again to Representative Reinbold's earlier question about what could the legislature do about price and quality transparency. We're going to continue that study looking at legislation from other states, and I anticipate coming up with some recommendations related to an all-payer claims database. Continuing the conversation with the business sector and employers about what could be done to better support them, and looking at the evidence-based medicine question and how to advance that in health plan design here in the state. That's it.
Representative Keller.
I just want to say thank you for your coming. We're honored that you're here, and good presentation. I also want to apologize, you know, for the collision of the schedules. It happens this time of year. Sometimes it gets pretty confusing, but I'm sure that made for an uncomfortable situation, and I'm sorry. You know, I apologize personally. But thanks. This is very valuable.
I will ditto that also.
I'll echo it as well.
But we got through it. And what I would like to do, as far as the Affordable Care Act goes, you guys have obviously looked at that and have kind of looked at how it's going to affect each of the departments and whatnot, right?
Representative Higgins, we haven't done a detailed analysis. Right after the law was passed in 2010, the commission was established within a month after that, and then started meeting that fall. And so one of the very first things we did was we commissioned a study that was done by ICER, the Institute for Social and Economic Research, to do kind of a high-level impact analysis at that point. So we have that study done very, very early on. The Department of Health and Social Services has a consultant on board right now who is doing a much more detailed and more current analysis. And I don't know the details of that study, if it's specific to the Medicaid expansion question or not. The other thing that we have done, though, is more of a high-level summary overview of the different provisions in the Act. So in our 2010 report, we have a narrative description of the major components of that Act and how they interact together. And then at each meeting, what we do is spend a little bit of time identifying for the individual provisions which ones are at which stage of being implemented and what's being done, what decisions have been made in Alaska. But we haven't done any detailed analysis of those individual provisions and the impacts on various state agencies.
Well, I was just wondering if there's a way possibly have you come back and give us kind of the nuts and bolts of that summary overview on the Affordable Care Act, I think would be great.
We would be happy to do that.
If you could do that, and if you could get it done in 2 hours. You know, I don't know how thick summary is, but that would be your challenge, I think, is to try to do that. But I think if you can possibly line that up, I think the committee would appreciate that. Okay. Representative Seaton?
Thank you. On page 8 of your recommendations, which is number 7, focus on prevention.
I'm sorry, we don't have a copy in front of us, but I'm sure we remember them.
Oh,
please,
okay.
Go ahead.
I guess I'm seeing a 2009 recommendation and 4 2011 recommendations. Are there recommendations going forward as well, or is it that the 2011 recommendations are still the existing prevention and we haven't expanded that?
Thank you. Representative Seaton, through the chair, all of the commission's recommendations to date are still considered current recommendations, and some of these recommendations have actually been implemented. And there is an analysis. We tried to, in this document, which is the core strategies and policy recommendations document, have listed all of the current recommendations made to date, and those years that are listed there represent the year in which that recommendation was made. The initial commission that was created by Governor Palin under administrative order and that met during the year 2009, the calendar year 2009, the new commission, after it was established in statute and expanded somewhat and had some new members appointed, voted to carry forward those, adopt essentially those earlier recommendations from 2009. And the year next to each of these recommendations signified not just the year in which that recommendation was passed by the commission, but also notes the annual report that you could go back to reference to get more background information or to see the finding statements related to the given recommendation.
So So there weren't any prevention recommendations, focus on prevention recommendations in 2012. Is that what I'm...
Representative Seaton, through the chair, that's correct.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any other questions? Nope. Thank you for your presentation once again. We really do appreciate it. Well, I'll apologize one more time for all the confusion today, but I do appreciate you having the patience with us on that. Okay, with that.
For the opportunity.
Oh, thank you. Our next HES committee meeting will be scheduled for 3 p.m. on March the 12th. Okay? So we don't have any presentations till scheduled until the 12th. We'll bring HB 16, Adult Public Assistant Eligibility Backup Fund 8. It is now 4:31, and this meeting is adjourned.